Columbia River Basin Salmon Management Policy, C-3620. This is a discussion, next steps, and possible guidance. We always need guidance. It's what my wife tells me every morning.
It's kind of sort of like the last Tammy just to stay up.
The gunny sergeant. Good morning again, Mr. Twite.
Commissioners, Chair, Director, Bill Twite in front of you, along with Ryan Lothrop, and we're back on Columbia River Policy C-3620. This morning, we're confining our presentation to coverage of the additional information that you requested when we presented this to you last, and then looking for some guidance, which I think we've already received a lot of it concerning next steps, but if there were any additional thoughts on that. And then hoping as well that you will act at this point to direct us to finalize the review work that we've done for you.
Good morning. So one of the additional items that you we're hoping to get a look at was the total harvest in the Columbia River Basin that came out of the October 15th meeting. So we consolidated our efforts to look at creel sample data, your catch record cards, your harvest cards, as well as your landings within the commercial fishery. So we looked from the main stem all the way up to the tributaries, basically the Chief Joseph Dam, including the select areas for commercial and rec, and tributaries within Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. So what we have here provided up there is, and this is in your handouts as well, in more detail actually than what we're seeing up there. Sport fishery during the 2010 to 2012 had, for Chinook, Coho, and Steelhead, harvested, so retained fish, 411,000 fish, and during the policy years, 363,000. As you're aware, commercial fisheries have to release steelhead, so when you're looking at just Chinook and Coho, during the pre-policy years, you have 184,000 fish, and then during policy years, approximately 141,000. But if you're to compare pre-policy or a policy comparison between Chinook and Coho only, sport has within Washington, Oregon, and Idaho, main stem and tributaries, 58% of Chinook and Coho harvest, and commercial is 42%. And again, more information, more detail is provided in the packet, which will provide those tables in the review report, as well as I think there'll be some more detailed tables within the appendix of the report. So I'm going to move on unless there are questions on this.
And again, we want to stress that just interpreting these just in light of the policy would be incorrect. There are myriad of factors that affect catch in any particular year by either recreational or sport, including the fact that we're now showing you information from three states, so three state managers. So a lot of folks thought it would be important to try to step back and get the big picture. That's what's here, but the big picture is complicated by numerous parameters.
So the next item that we gathered up was bycatch information that was requested to take a look at. So basically within the, I'll start with the commercial. So we had, we looked at both actual fisheries and then our research fisheries. And so we even incorporated those reports that were brought about by the public on October 15th. So those reports are contained within these rolled up summaries. Again, more details on each year, each report of this information is in the packet that you have that will go into the full report. But looking at gillnet fisheries, we looked at both expanded and observed. And for actual fisheries, we're looking at percent released of fish that were basically not being obtained in the sense. And so good net fishery, part of that would be steelhead as well as sturgeon in some cases too. So gill net fisheries, we had 22% of the fish were released that they captured in a sense in the gill nets, and so those would have been salmon, steelhead, and sturgeon that would have been released. Spring tangle net fisheries, which we observed, those were 31%. Moving on to the research spring tangle net and the research gill net, there's a little bit of a difference there. The intention isn't to fish, it's to learn about the fishery. So you're fishing maybe a wider time step. So in times that we're actually not fishing anymore or wouldn't fish if we had a choice on the best utilize ESA impacts, for example. Or also, like, for example, in the spring Chinook tangle fishery, with all the shad that come back, you want to avoid that run time in the shad, so you fish an actual fishery earlier. So that's just a caveat of the research numbers up there of 73%. Also, that 73% does include all species, so shad, sturgeon, steelhead.
Yes. Commissioner Grable? Baker, I'm sorry.
Really quick question.
Yes.
When you say 22% are released, is there a mortality number there, or are they released or dead?
Just straight up released, alive or dead.
Okay, that's...
Yep, there is no mortality associated with these percentages. This is just straight up individual fish. Yep. This was an attempt to... Because every fishery has a different release mortality rate, so they're not necessarily apples to apples on the sense of what a number of fish released. So in this case, we're just looking at percents released that were encountered or handled. The research gill net fishery, again, that's a research test fishery, is 36%. For non-target, so that's the difference. So the, as I mentioned, the actual fishery we're looking at percent released for research or test fisheries, we're calling that non-target. So that's outside the scope of the research. Within the sport fishery, spring Chinook time period, you know, we're looking at salmon, steelhead, and sturgeon being released. So 21% were released. Summer Chinook fishery, 42%. Fall Chinook, 21%. Summer steelhead, 42%. And the white sturgeon, the caveat there is you have a year-round catch-and-release fishery going on, and then you have your small retention fisheries. So we excluded the years without retention fisheries. So only the years that we did have some level of retention fishery, those years rolled up would be 89% release, which part of that is the slot limit size as well as the catch-release aspect. I guess the take-home message is there's every fishery has bycatch, if you want to call it that, or fish that are released. So that's at a high level, that's the take-home message on this.
Mm-hmm. And there's a couple reasons for bycatch. Bycatch includes... Bycatch is all fish that the gear encounter that end up not getting kept, but instead getting released or returned dead to the water. Sometimes it's like in the recreational fishery for sturgeon, it's because that's what we require. We simply don't allow retention sometimes part of the year, but we still encourage some amount of catch and release. That all counts as bycatch. When it is open for retention, as you're aware, there's only a slot limit that's allowed for retention. The rest are bycatch. Is that good? Is that bad? We're not trying to put any labels on that. Just point out that bycatch can occur because of that, or it can occur because you're fishing for one species and they're extensively commingled with another that you either don't want to keep for market purposes or because for recreational purposes they're just not keepable, or you're required not to keep them. Again, it can be for a range of reasons. So viewing a low bycatch rate as intrinsically good and a high bycatch rate as intrinsically bad is not the proper lens to be using. Instead, you've got to sort of understand why it's occurring, and it usually ends up being a pretty complicated story.
All right, excuse me. The next item that we gathered was the pre-policy years for the price per pound. So that's the 2010 through 2012 for each of the commercial fisheries up there. Again, this information, we will insert that those pre-policy years into the report. As you compare the numbers, you can see policy years, the price went up versus pre-policy years. That is not... It did not occur due to the policy. It's a world market or, supply and demand. I think the request was to look at and see what those the price was during pre-policy year. So that's what is up here. All right. So moving forward, and we actually went into some depth on these items, so I guess I don't know if we need to go back through those specifically, but the ongoing project updates were the commercial license buyback, pound net alternative gear testing, and logbooks. So I guess maybe if there's any questions or further information on any of these topics, or Bill, anything else you want to add to what we mentioned yesterday?
The only thing I want to add is that we've been corresponding with Wild Fish Conservancy over the last few weeks about jointly submitting a Salt and Stall Kennedy grant for operation of the pound net sort of as a final year of evaluation beginning in the fall of 2019 and going for a full year, so through the spring of 2020. It'll be several months before we know. The grant application is due in a couple days. It'll be several months before we know whether or not we get it. Wild Fish Conservancy does believe they've got money, though, for funding already for evaluation this coming spring, for additional evaluation this coming spring.
I thought it was 270-ish.
Ballpark, yeah.
Less than 300K, somewhere in the 250 to 300 is our memory, but it's on my computer. I can run back and get it. But
Commissioner,
thank you. I have a thought on adding one item to the ongoing projects list or update, and it might be a tough one. But as we go through this policy review and trying to make the right decisions for the different user groups or resource and so on, there's some environmental issues out there that are bothersome to many of us. Is there any way that you can create a back of the envelope prediction on what the run sizes, what you expect these respective species to do over the next 5 to 10 years? Do you expect them to increase, decrease, stay the same? I mean, I think what we're being asked to do is not easy, but if we had some visionary perspective on what to expect from the resource, I think that might be helpful to us.
And before you answer, I think Commissioner Gribble wanted to add to that.
One of the things that I had requested that I didn't see when I scrolled through the presentation was just a brief report that indicated the current gillnet size, fleet size, for both Washington and Oregon. And I do have information that was provided the last time we did this review. You know, how many licenses are in Washington, Oregon, and their activity, and X vessel values for the fleet. Maybe that just didn't get to you, but that's something I requested at the last meeting that be included with this final line items of things to consider.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I thought that was going to add on. Okay. It was a different thing. So if you wanted to address Commissioner Carpenter's concern.
Yeah. We can certainly take a look at the Chinook cycles as we best understand them. The Chinook cycles of product. We can try to give you a sense of where we are on those cycles. Steelhead cycles appear to be a little more poorly understood, but we may have... We will talk to both our counterparts in Oregon and Idaho and see what we can do there. Coho, as you know, is really hard. it's trying to look down the road much for Co is extremely difficult.
Yeah, I don't know if Ron has issued you a crystal ball or not yet, but I just whatever we could learn or what the expectations might be, I from my perspective, I think it would be helpful.
He did, but I'm still having a hard time learning how to operate it.
You got to put batteries in it.
Oh.
Thank you, Bill.
And relative to Commissioner Graybill's request, we did hear that. Those materials are fundamental to working through the buyback discussions, and I believe they're still being sort of worked on. The issue, well, there's a couple issues. The overall number of licenses I believe we have, but figuring out who's active and sort of getting to that next step, that information that you need for buyback to really structure a buyback program correctly requires a lot of back and forth with industry as well in order to correctly interpret them. So I think that's where we are on that. So those data will be coming to you as part of our sort of first step in the buyback discussions.
I do have from a six-year survey that was published, but I think it's from 2012. But I don't know if you're familiar with that, but I have a copy here. That's for Washington. I know they're available in Oregon, too, in terms of fleet size and that sort of thing. And so
yeah,
I'd like to have that as part of the materials that we're reviewing for perspective.
Okay.
Commissioner Holzdorf?
Thank you, Chair.
I guess just to build on the statement that Chairman Carpenter made is it would be, as commissioners, helpful to know if we're headed, because we all know we went through 2015 with a really bad outflow year and we had the blob out there. And it would be very helpful to know that, yeah, that was a low dip. And if things restore back to quote-unquote normal, we'll at least bounce back up, because I get that question posed to me, and I always, oh, we just had a couple crappy years, we'll bounce back. But if that's not the case, that would be nice to know. And there again, it would also help us to know how urgent we are, because hatcheries are the only thing we get to fish off of in our part of the world. So those dollars seem to want to keep drying up, so it might help us to a little sense of urgency. We need to be going the other way, not the wrong way. So thank you.
Yeah, we will. Our crystal ball on this, we certainly can talk about some of the longer term cycles and where we are, where we guess we are on those. But I also want to remind the commission that in the late 90s, when it just looked like the world was never going to come back around for salmon, when we were just in the worst hole that any of us have certainly experienced or can remember for salmon productivity, nobody would have guessed how fast we would go from essentially almost all reds in terms of marine indicators in 1999 to almost all greens in 2000. And within a year or two, we were restoring fisheries people thought we might never have again. So we knew we had to come out of the 90s, but nobody would have guessed how quickly or how dramatically we'd bounce back from the 90s. So that'll be part of the caveat as well, as we can kind of try to tell you where we think we are, but that, and we think we are headed in, say, for Upriver Brights. We think we've seen the peak of that cycle and are certainly heading towards the lower parts of that cycle of productivity for Upriver Brights, which are obviously one of the main things. But again, it just, when the ocean changes on you, it can change really dramatically and almost overnight in either direction. And we sure saw that to our benefit in between 1999 and 2000. And again, if you'll recall that from Thursday, that the red light, green light thing that NIMS produces, it's dramatic in that. I mean, the column that's 99 is almost all red. The column that's 2000 is almost all green. So if you'll keep that in mind, that will be helpful to us.
Commissioner Thornburg?
I don't know whether we'd actually call it a project, but something I want to keep in front of us is, as we move forward with this, and it's probably more for the long-term in the way that we're sort of looking at how we're moving forward. I hope to see this be more of a basin-wide policy in the future, and we've had really outstanding input from and thoughtful input from our southeastern stakeholders. We're looking forward to working with upriver main stem issues of production. Above dams may become important, and so I'm wondering, or I would feel comfortable that that's going to stay in front of us, as maybe it's listed as one of the ongoing projects, even though it doesn't quite fit projects as you presented them here, just to keep it in front of us.
Actually, can I respond to that briefly?
Sure. Yeah, I wasn't pushing that.
Commissioner, we actually should have had listed on this, and so thank you for pointing this out, and I think Commissioner Greenville's looking at me with an I told you so look. We should have had development of the Upper Columbia, revisions to the Upper Columbia Sand Management Plan as one of the other ongoing implementation plans, and just a reminder to the commissioners of how that fits in. And then I'll make a staff plea as well in response. If you will direct us to finalize this report, we can return some of our energies to some of these ongoing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought Commissioner Carpenter's comment is important to certainly to consider, but what I'm hearing staff say, and I think from my own personal experience, is very difficult to predict what the future will hold. And I think, to me, that reinforces the need that any changes that we make to the policy or the policy itself needs to be robust. It needs to be something that can be used in years of strong returns, and it needs to be something that can have utility in years of weak returns. And so rather than trying to, kind of predict what the future will be and then tailor your policy toward that, because you very well may be wrong. So in that regard, I think with that in mind, I think that's in favor of some sort of matrix approach that is one of the ideas that have been put forth by the public to consider. So that's my kind of two cents on that. Rather than focus on what may be, which is very difficult, make sure that the policy is robust enough to work well in all situations.
Right.
Yeah, just one additional follow-up on, if you recall back in 2012 with the work group, what my understanding is staff attempted to forecast what the run sizes were, and so for an example, Fall Chinook came in 2.5 times larger than expected, so it can go either way, but that's just, don't want to put any expectations on what staff has with this crystal ball or not, but just, keep it in perspective. Thank you.
Commissioner Greenville.
Thank you, Bill. you're right. We anticipated some impacts to our lower river development to be impacted by some of the upper river concerns. And probably the one that is most important to address would be the spring salmon allotment and catch balancing issue that's ongoing. We didn't get to it this meeting, but the letter from the Snake River Recovery Board offers some options and suggestions that I think really address that issue. That's probably the most important issue that we need to address, I think, before we can finalize the policy on the Lower Columbia River.
Continue on, then, General.
All right. Well, that kind of kicked us off into other ideas. And from what Commissioner Graybill just mentioned, we received 15 different ideas of how to change the Spring Chinook allotment. Yeah. So there's been a lot of attention there. So this list of ideas that we gathered, obviously, there are more ideas out there. We've seen some trickle in since we developed this list. So just to be aware that there's more than what we have provided you. That being said, could kind of briefly skim through some of these, but I mean, you've heard everything from don't change anything to change it completely. Spring Chinook allocation is a big one. We touched a lot of this on Thursday, actually. You know, funding for buyback, hire an alternative gear expert, bring them into the mix to help help staff, allow spring Chinook tangle nets, you know, increase safe areas in Washington, have more interface with the conservation boards, recovery boards, you know, look at hatchery surplus, needs to be considered or reduced for hatchery production, lobby for more funding. I mean, the list goes on and on. So maybe I'll just hit a couple parts, but, you know, we also have heard conservation should be the overriding principle. Mandate for more selective fisheries throughout the entire basin. obviously, change allocations, one that's been brought about. So, I mean, in a sense, this is something that hopefully you'll have time to kind of review the list, if that's what the next step is, which we can come back to these ideas if you have any further questions on. Otherwise, I think maybe we just jump into what's next. So I'll quickly hit it off and follow up with Bill's plea. We'd like to finalize this report that we've been working on the last 6 to 8 months. We've got the additional materials we're going to incorporate, and our intention is to have this done by before Thanksgiving, hopefully. and then, of course, you know, we would obviously get this published formally within our WDFW publications. It's a commission report. We would post on our website to make sure our advisors and commissioners all have a final copy material to walk through the rest of the winter and the next steps as we move forward. So I guess,
Brian?
Yes.
Commissioner McIsaac.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, before we get to public comment on this, I just wanted to... There's no public comment on this? Okay. Well, let me state at any rate, before we say anything more, I wanted to compliment the staff and everybody who was involved in this. It's been a Herculean effort since last January to do all this business. You all put Charles Atlas to shame. He only carried the world around on his shoulders, and you guys have done more than that. As recent ago as October 15th, we asked for a few more details, and here we are on November 3rd, actually before the meeting started, posted on the briefing book, the answers to those questions relative to price per pound, bycatch numbers, and all the rest. So just an outstanding, exceptional job. One of the next steps here is to finalize the report. And so I would say in terms of adding in the material that you've presented here today and maybe including some of the comments made at the staff table. For example, Mr. Twight on slide 3 talked about wrongful interpretation of those numbers, and it would be wrong to interpret it this way. It'd be a mistake to interpret it that way. But you can add a paragraph in wherever that table is located so that the casual reader a year or two from now understands that, and some explanatory language on the bycatch or the incidental catch. Bycatch is a pretty nasty word out there if it's used in some arenas. And, you know, incidental catch is a little different. And as you mentioned on sturgeon, part of the release of sturgeon is part of, key part of the fishery, that why people go out to catch and release on sturgeon. So, but anyway, I guess I'd urge the commission to formally accept the staff report contingent upon the additions that they presented here today and a final proofing and editing clerical exercise by November 15th. That'd be another excellent Herculean effort, but it would wrap this up and provide the basis for our deliberations in 2019.
Yeah, Thank you. Commissioner Bomer.
Thank you. I am really pleased with the work that the staff did on these additional items. And I am glad to hear that they're going to be incorporated into the report. And as well, thought some of the comments that you made, Bill, as kind of overview. Also on the harvest, you know, this is really high level. And just to put a sentence or two in, kind of summarizing comments that you made. What I think I heard Commissioner McIsaac say, though, if I understood, was to change the bycatch section to incidental catch?
No,
okay.
I didn't say change anything. Just explanatory in the explanatory.
Okay, because I really would urge that we continue to use bycatch. That's what we've heard in the testimony to point out. It's a very hot issue, and we've got a NOAA fisheries definition in here, and it is bycatch. We're responding to what we've been hearing, so I think we need to use that terminology.
Mr. Keel.
That's a good segue to my comments and questions. And if the chair would indulge me.
Always.
So there was in public testimony last meeting, I think, during the panel discussions, there was the term junk science was used. And as I recall, the term was used in the context or describing the mortality rates observed for released steelhead as a result of the 2017 monitoring program in the commercial fishery in zones 4 and 5 in the fall. And as I recall, and please correct me, staff, if I'm misstating this, there was a modification to the survival or mortality rate, I should say, for released steelhead in the commercial fall fishery with the 9-inch mesh size. And am I okay? Right. So there was criticism then of that, of the results and the modifications to that. The existing survival rate was assumed was lowered as a result of the pretty extensive analysis that was done. So I did a little research this morning and went to the internet, of course, to find out what the definition of junk science is. And if I may, the term junk science...
Are you looking at me when you...
is used to describe scientific data, research, or analysis considered by the person using the phrase to be spurious or fraudulent. The concept is often involved in political and legal contexts where facts and scientific results have a great amount of weight in making a determination. It usually conveys a pejorative connotation that the research has been untowardly driven by political, ideological, financial, or otherwise unscientific motives. So I think it would be useful, Bill or Ryan, to maybe explain the process that went through that was used in changing the survival or mortality rates for encountered steelhead in the gillnet fall fishery. So, you know, in terms of maybe you could just take us through the steps of what that process was.
Thank you, Commissioner, I think. One of the more challenging scientific endeavors that we have in fisheries management is trying to estimate the survival of fish that have been handled and released. And part of the reason it's so challenging is that in order to conduct the scientific evaluation, you've got to handle and release fish, and you're trying to study the effect of handling and releasing. So it is extremely difficult. And it's an area that we're always working at to try to improve, and it's an area where we often will sometimes even go through older studies and maybe even revise them some. So I think there's some understandable confusion. A lot of our stakeholders are used to an experiment being done, and that's the result, and it never changes. With handling, we do sometimes see changes, or we see additional information coming in through through monitoring programs or things like that that allow us to make revisions. When we're doing science like that, we recognize that it's more challenging, and so that's, we really believe that the best way then to handle that kind of science, to ensure that it's science done with integrity and science done as impartially as possible, is to make extensive use of a peer review system. That's why we really rely on peer review for, in particular, for these kinds of estimates. We rarely accept an estimate just because a couple biologists in a room walked through some numbers and said, here's a change. What we do with that, and we did in this case as well, is we take it to our existing review groups. In this case, under USV Oregon, there's the Technical Advisory Committee. That's a group comprised of fishery management biologists and scientists from all the fishery management agencies, some of whom are sort of friendlier to or work for agencies that have a more positive view than others do of catch and release type fisheries. And so there's a healthy range of perspectives in that group. And so it serves as a very useful peer review body for that kind of work. And so in this case, after we in Oregon had sort of checked each other's work, the next level was taking it to the USV Oregon Technical Advisory Committee for their review. And then after that, National Marine Fisheries Service still has to review it as well on their own before they're willing to adopt it, since in this case it related to a listed species. And ultimately, it's their call. And so they in essence conduct a final layer of review. We take a lot of comfort from the sort of multiple layers of review when we're working with these kinds of numbers. And we believe that's the best way to ensure that it's, in fact, solid science.
Okay. Thanks. And just one quick follow-up. Was there ever... I assume that data would be made available to anyone who requested it to truth the analysis or even do their own analysis. Mm-hmm. Was that ever done in this case? Or maybe I should ask, was there ever an analysis of the data that you had that came up with a different result that was presented to you for your consideration?
We did have one NGO... but only one request those data, and we had to redact a little bit of information out of it, but not any of the information that was necessary to arrive at the mortality rate, more just protecting the identities of the individual harvesters who we observed as part of the monitoring program. And we supplied that to them a year ago, I believe.
This summer.
Okay. Anyway, we've not heard any... We've not seen any scientific analysis from them that we could respond to. We actually would appreciate receiving others' analyses. It's always useful to take a look at what somebody else has done with the same data and see if they arrive at either a similar or different conclusion. We've seen no analysis to date.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
You sounded very lawyerly this morning.
Yeah.
Commissioner Craybill.
Yes, Commissioner Kehoe. I did want to just mention, though, that there has been some controversy around the findings of the TAC committee and this process. I don't want it to sound like the results haven't been challenged. How formally, I don't know. But yes, there are people and organizations that are not satisfied with that result, and I just wanted to mention that.
And what we look for is an alternate analysis.
Yes,
if somebody presents us with an alternate analysis, we certainly will look at that. Simply telling us that they don't agree with the numbers,
yeah, if they
doesn't
don't like
give
the answer,
us anything to work with.
Yeah. Yeah. I just didn't want it to appear that it has not been questioned.
We're aware that, I mean, when we produce a forecast, a lot of people tell us they don't like the forecast. We can't do anything with that.
You want to respond to that too, Ryan?
Well, it's not necessarily a response other than, we strive to do the best we can with the available information we have. And so as we move through this process, new information is going to come available, through the next steps for policy, what's around the corner. So as a heads up, and it's actually in the report, the 2017 PERSANE study, there's a synopsis already in the report when it's under draft phase. That report is in the very near completion of being published, so that should be made available in a final published report December. That's the 2017 PERSANE study. And with our ongoing pound network, I expect that we'll put something together on that. So, of course, as we move forward, which is nothing new to commissioners, we'll bring new information when it's available forward.
Mr. Carpenter?
Yeah, I'd just like to back up a little bit here a minute and hit on what I brought up earlier as futuristic forecasting. And I very much appreciate Commissioner Kehoe's perspective on it. I don't disagree with him at all. But I think back on a number of things, and if we can, I think it's critically important to find some tools so we can be better planners. And I think back about, I think about NOAA and the National Weather Service. You know, they've got some intel. The one I want to touch on, of course, National Marine Fisheries Service, but I want to touch on the Pacific Salmon Commission. Ron, you're very familiar with that. U.S.-Canada just recently renegotiated U.S.-Canada treaty. They're sitting there with a Southern Endowment Fund and a Northern Endowment Fund, for that matter, which a lot of money is sitting there. And I served on the Southern Panel for, which is Washington and Oregon, for 15 years. And they're looking for projects to spend that money in a meaningful way to benefit both countries. And the reason I think it's so important to push this a little bit and not just discount the idea of trying to find opportunities to be better managers is it's not just the Columbia River. We're talking about the Columbia River now, but it's not just the Columbia River that's in trouble. I mean, the coastal rivers, the Puget Sound rivers, are all ESA listed. The Fraser River is tanking on many of its species, Chinook, certainly, and sockeye to some degree. The Skeena rivers on the entire coast. So I don't have the tools to know how we go about this, but I would suggest we spend a little time on seeing if we can get a bigger crystal ball. I just wanted to reiterate that.
Can I respond briefly to that too? Thank you, Commissioner. I as staff completely agree with that, and Ryan has been working pretty closely with some of the folks who are do our forecasting to try to begin to include more of a some more retrospective data, just to give us more of a sense of where we are on some of these cycles. At what point are we? Instead of our forecasts have always been almost always just a snapshot in time, and looking forward as well would be extremely useful. I think all commissioners have also heard me say that for Chinook in particular, you can start at the Yukon and you can go all the way to the Sacramento and you're not going to find much good news. And my hesitancy then is that's different. In the past, when things were tough down here in the Columbia, they were often good in Alaska and vice versa. There was pretty clearly an alternating sort of marine survival that, even though we didn't fully understand it, kind of made intuitive sense, at least, that not everybody can do well at the same time in the ocean. It appears, though, to be that almost everybody can do poorly at the same time in the ocean. And that's a new observation for us. And it's a chilling one, too. But in a way, I could just say I just did your 5-year for Chinook right there. We'll try to do it a little better. But at the moment, when everything's going downhill, we all revert to cautionary mode as scientists.
No, Bill, let me just follow up real quick, Brad, if I may. I know it's not easy to craft a model, a futuristic model, but it would sure it would sure be a valuable tool if we could come up with some kind of a basic model of what we can expect, economics, social economics, the resource management. I can go on and on. So I appreciate your response and your thoughts on that, Bill.
Thank you.
And Bill, Commissioner Carpenter mentioned the funding opportunity. That triggered a thought in my mind that some of these modeling projects could be North Pacific Research Board. I mean, that, and especially when you have, when you mentioned, you know, UConn to Sacramento, that would be some very attractive proposals, I would think. So I would encourage that, seeing how I sit on that, too.
Thank you for your generous offer.
Commissioner Baker.
It seems to me that modeling in the future is dicey one way or another, as you pointed out. I do want to make sure that I state that I totally agree with Commissioner Kehoe in that this policy that we're talking about has to be durable enough to deal with what the flows are, but also it is based on conservation, and we want to do what we can to conserve and protect the species that are there. That said, there's modeling, and then there's, you know, high intensity warnings, and what I remember from yesterday is the discussion on winter steelhead, and it was like 89% risk of extinction. That's not modeling. That's, good God, what are we going to do? And the staff people that told us that said, you know, basically 90% of extinction unless something's done. And the discussion happened in the context of sea lions. But I think it all folds together at some point. You know, there's not going to be any fish to fish if we're not going to have any abundance. And so I guess when we're talking about modeling, what would be helpful to me is to as you do this, and I'm not, this isn't an extra chore that I'm asking for, but to be put on full alert about what's going to happen today, tomorrow, or next week, that if we did something, we might be able to reverse the trajectory so that there are fish to fish, whether it's commercial or wrecks.
One of the things I'm hearing out of this discussion is that as we think about crafting for some of the areas that you want us to focus on in this, when we have that discussion, as we think about how we would craft the alternatives, some of the alternatives will need to take these dynamics into account. Greater level of precautionary, how do you craft a fairly robust, a resilient approach to a broad range? How do you deal with impending sort of potentially dire situations? Maybe take all three of those into account as we're thinking about the kinds of alternatives to analyze in response to,
I think we have to
your,
to.
Yeah.
Okay, you want to continue?
I think that's it.
Ending on a high note.
Yeah. Well, sorry to answer the end of.
Yeah.
Well done, boys.
Yes, thank you.
Well done.
Thank you. No.
No.
Just possible guidance. So.
Yeah, because it's still.
I think that's helpful to finalize it, because I think they want
to. Ron, do you need anything from us to finalize?
Chair Smith, Ron Warren. So, commissioners, thank you very much for all of your comments. I don't want to walk away other than the topics that were talked about to be added, to think that there is another expectation before we finalize this document. And so I just want to come up to assure staff, assure myself, that from a commission perspective, I'm getting head nods down the line that we're done. other than what we just talked about.
I think I can speak for all of us. We will not blindside you on anything more.
I'm satisfied. Thank you.
We're done. Mr. Chairman, yes. Just one last sealing up of that matter. If we could just ensure that when the minutes come out that there's a sentence that says that the commission accepted the report as final contingent upon the completions that were discussed.
And that is a sentence, not a paragraph.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
So that brings us to a conclusion of that. Well, that was a rather informative and expedited and intelligent briefing. Thank you.